Okay. So we're going to talk a bit now about how mindfulness connects with jhana. Okay. You mentioned earlier, it was passage 5, I think. Where they talk about the establishing of mindfulness and then the development of the establishing of mindfulness. Now, these are two different stages in the practice, and they both connect very directly to the practice of concentration. With the establishing of mindfulness, you are establishing your frame of reference, where you're going to keep your attention focused, and whatever comes up, you're going to look at it from within that frame. So when an emotion comes up while you're focused on the body, in and of itself, the first thing you want to look for is, how is this affecting the body? And how is the body feeding the emotion? So you're looking at the body as your primary frame of reference. And you're trying to establish that regardless of whatever comes up, you're going to stay focused on that frame. So that's just an intentional narrowing of your awareness, that you've got this one frame and you're not going to leave that frame unless you consciously decide, okay, this is not the frame for this problem. I need another frame. Then you shift your frame consciously. Now, most of us are very unconscious about how we how we shift our frame of awareness. You're looking at the body for a bit. Oh, then you're off with the feeling, and then you're off with the thought, and you're back to the body again, without really seeing the stages. So, in this case, if you do change your frame of reference, you're going to do it consciously. There was a science fiction short story that I read years back. I can't remember the name of the story or the author. But the basic conceit of the story was that they had finally figured out a way to do interstellar travel with a spaceship that didn't require fuel. All it had to do was change its frame of reference. Neat idea, no? You know, if your frame of reference is Earth, okay, you're staying right here. If your frame of reference is the sun, all you have to do is zip. You're not moving, but now you've got a new frame of reference, and the Earth is zipped off that way, and you're right here. And then you could change your frame of reference to the center of the galaxy and just be way off pretty quickly. And the main thing that drove the plot of the story was that whenever the spaceship changed its frame of reference, everybody on board would go unconscious. And different people were unconscious for different lengths of time. That's how the plot developed. Some people woke up before others did. So I always thought that was a really nice image for the mind, you know, that some of us wake up quickly and don't get tricks played on us like the people who wake up slowly. Okay? So what we're trying to do, if you're going to change your frame of reference, you change it consciously. But for the main part of your meditation is to learn how to establish one frame of reference and stick with it, and don't wander off in other places. That's the establishing of mindfulness. The developing of the establishing mindfulness from the point of view of concentration practice is that once you've learned how to establish your topic of concentration, you learn how to maintain it in different situations. Whatever comes up, you begin to see, okay, what is it that is destroying the concentration, and how do I go about bringing the concentration back? You're seeing it in terms of cause and effect. Okay, what was it that pulled me away? Why did it pull me away? How can I get it back? So it's a study in cause and effect. And learning, and the more consistently you try to maintain this, the more you learn about cause and effect in the mind. It's like having a reference point. Excuse me, I'm losing my voice this afternoon. You have a reference point to watch clouds. If you're lying on your back out in the middle of a field watching clouds, you can look up there, and after a while you're not really sure which clouds are moving, which ones are not, because you don't have a point of reference. If you have your point of reference, like a top of a roof or a telephone pole or something, you can look at it and see, sure enough, okay, these clouds are moving, these ones are not. And so what you're trying to establish here as you establish mindfulness is that point of reference. So you can see when something's moving in the mind and which direction it's moving. And as you learn how to maintain that, you're beginning to learn more and more more and more about the process of fabrication as it goes on with the breath, verbal fabrication, bodily fabrication, mental fabrication going on in the mind. Then finally, as I said, there was that one paragraph that was missing from passage 5, which is that the path to the practice, path of practice to the development of the establishing of mindfulness is all 8 factors of the path. That includes right concentration or jhana. a couple things come up in this passage. One is about the internal and external. Now, if it's you're thinking about mindfulness simply in the terms of, you know, observing, okay, you're not going to be able to observe thoughts in other people. You're not going to be able to observe their feelings. But if you think of mindfulness as something you're keeping in mind, you can use this as a frame of reference in terms of, okay, what am I feeling right now? How about other people? Do they feel the same thing? Other people are feeling the same thing. This is to give you a sense of sangvega about the whole process, about wherever you go, whatever you become, you're still going to have these same issues of feelings and issues coming up in the body, thoughts and everything. And many times you'll see in the suttas where the Buddha recommends that you reflect on what you're doing or what you're experiencing right now. And then he says, okay, expand that to realize, okay, everybody else is going through this too, one way or another. And the purpose of that is to gain a sense of heedfulness, gain a sense of sangvega, the sense, okay, I don't want to stay on in this cycle that much longer. I want to get out. So that would be the purpose of the external. Okay. The canon does also contain some analogies and stories for these different states. The first one is when you're actually trying to establish your frame of reference, and you have to be resistant to anything that's going to pull you away. And passage 9, we can look at this right now. Suppose, monks, that a large crowd of people comes thronging together, saying, the beauty queen, and suppose that the beauty queen is highly accomplished at singing and dancing. So then an even greater crowd comes thronging, saying, the beauty queen is singing, the beauty queen is dancing. Then a man comes along, desiring life and shrinking from death, desiring pleasure and abhorring pain. They say to him, now look here, mister, you must take this bowl filled to the brim with oil, and carry it on your head in between the great crowd and the beauty queen. Motorcycles will pass by on the road. Okay. A man raised with a sword, with raised sword, will follow right behind you, and wherever you spill even a drop of oil, right there will he cut off your head. Now what do you think? Would that man not paying attention to the bowl of oil bring heedlessness outside? No. Okay, so I've given you this simile to convey a meaning. The meaning is this: the bowl filled to the brim with oil stands for mindfulness immersed in the body. Okay, it's interesting, he doesn't talk about what the beauty queen stands for and what the crowd stands for. I would say the beauty queen stands for objects of the senses, and the crowd stands for all your desires for those objects. And you've got to stand in the middle and not let yourself get swayed. There are a couple other passages where it make a similar point. There are in the Himalayas, the king of mountains, difficult uneven areas where neither monkeys nor human beings wander. There are difficult uneven areas where monkeys wander but not human beings. There are level stretches of land delightful where both monkeys and human beings wander. In such spots, hunters set a tar trap in the monkeys' tracks in order to catch some monkeys. Those monkeys who are not foolish or careless, this is not in your readings. Those monkeys who are not foolish or careless by nature, when they see the tar trap, will keep their distance. But any monkey who is foolish and careless by nature comes up to the tar trap and grabs it with its paw, which then gets stuck. Thinking, I'll free my paw, he grabs it with his other paw. That too gets stuck. You see where this is going. Okay. Thinking, I'll free both of my paws, he grabs it with his foot. That too gets stuck. Thinking, I'll free both of my paws and my foot, he grabs it with his other foot. That too gets stuck. Thinking, I'll free both of my paws and my feet as well, he grabs it with his mouth. That too gets stuck. Okay. So the monkey, snared in the five ways, lies there whimpering, having fallen on misfortune, falling on ruin, a prey to whatever the hunter wants to do with him. Okay. Then the hunter, without releasing the monkey, skewers him right there, picks him up, and goes off as he likes. He said, this is what happens to anyone who wanders into what is not his proper range and is the territory of others. And then he goes on to say that the four frames of reference are your proper territory as a meditator, and the pleasures of the senses are the territory of others. So, in other words, you've got to keep this in mind while you're keeping your frame of reference and trying to establish your frame of reference as solidly as possible. Another similar story. Once a hawk suddenly swooped down on a quail and seized it. I love this conversation. Then the quail, as it was being carried off by the hawk, lamented, oh, just my bad luck and lack of merit. Isn't that the first thought that comes to your mind? That I was wandering out of my proper range and into the territory of others. If only I'd kept to my proper range today, to my own ancestral territory, this hawk would have been no match for me in battle. So the hawk says, well, what is your proper range? What is your own ancestral territory? And the baby quail says, a newly plowed field with clumps of earth all turned up. So the hawk, without bragging about its own strength, without mentioning its own strength, let go of the quail. Go, quail, but even there, when you've gone there, you won't escape me. Then the quail, having gone down to a newly plowed field with clumps of earth all turned up, and climbing on top of a large clump of earth, stood taunting the hawk. Now come and get me, you hawk. Now come and get me, you hawk. So the hawk, without bragging about its own strength, without mentioning its own strength, folded its two wings and suddenly swooped down toward the quail. When the quail knew the hawk is coming at me full speed, it slipped behind a clump of earth. And right there the hawk shattered its own breast. This is what happens to anyone who wanders into what is not his proper range and is the territory of others. So, same message. Okay? So that's what you keep in mind as you're in this stage of the mindfulness practice. But you've got to establish your frame of reference as solidly as you can. You don't want to go wandering off. Now the second one is when you are looking into the process. Yes? You know what I mean? Well, what was it, George Bush in front of Mission Accomplished? You don't want to taunt too much, you know. But if you're really secure, you can say, what the hell? And see what happens. I mean, John Mahabua went through a phase when he said he thought he was rid of sensual desire. And he realized, wait, I'm not really sure, because there was never a point in the practice where there was a realization that really cut through things finally. It just seemed to kind of gradually disappear. He said he didn't trust that. And so he said, okay, let's bring it on. So he just imagined this beautiful woman right next to him all the time, wherever he went. And for 5 days, he didn't feel any desire for her at all. The sixth day, he said, it wasn't anything physical, it was just this thing that, you know, my mind really does like this. He said, okay, there's still some sensual desire there. So that would be the point when you have to test things. You think it's gone, okay, come back and test it. See if it's really gone. And in this case, it was. The hawk shattered its breast. Another, when you're getting, though, into the second level, this is when you are looking more into cause and effect. Okay, what is it that keeps the mind from settling down in different circumstances? And here the analogy of the cook, which is passage 16, comes in handy. Suppose that there is a foolish, inexperienced, unskillful cook who has presented a king or a king's minister with various kinds of curry, mainly sour, mainly bitter, mainly peppery, mainly sweet, alkaline or non-alkaline, salty or not salty. He does not take note of or does pick up on the theme of his master, thinking today my master likes this curry or reaches out for that curry or he takes a lot of this curry or he praises that curry. As a result, he is not rewarded with clothing or wages or gifts. Why is that? Because the foolish, inexperienced, unskillful cook does not pick up on the theme of its own master. In the same way, there are cases where a foolish, inexperienced, unskillful meditator remains focused on the body and of itself, ardent, alert, and mindful, subduing greed and distress with reference to the world. As you remain thus focused on the body in and of itself, your mind does not become concentrated. Your defilements are not abandoned. You do not take note of that fact. And the same with the other frames of reference. As a result, you are not rewarded with a pleasant abiding here and now, nor with mindfulness and alertness. Why is that? Because you do not take note of your own mind. And then it gives the opposite example of someone who does take note of his master. In other words, you've got to notice what your mind likes, and what's working and what's not working. And that way you learn about it. And in learning about it, you get more and more skilled at getting the mind to settle down and stay there. And then the pleasure and inner strength that comes from that. So in this particular second phase, you're looking at the process of cause and effect within the practice of trying to get the mind to stay down in all kinds of situations. So that's the second phase. So in both cases, you're working both with mindfulness and with concentration at the same time. And the second phase is where we'll talk a little bit later about how concentration leads into discernment, but this is one of the primary ways right away from the very beginning of the practice, learning to step back from things that are happening in your mind so you know how to read them and then adjust for whatever needs to be adjusted. So any there any questions on that before we go through the readings? Mm-hmm. Well, on the one hand, you have to learn how to cut down on the stimuli. I mean, there's a certain amount that you are being bombarded with, but a certain amount you're opening the door and letting them in. So to what extent do you want to keep on opening the door, and to what extent do you want to say, okay, I've got enough? Yes. Right, right. It's saying don't lose touch of your body. And if you know that, find that you're drifting off, you say, I've got to come back and then find something to get me more interested in my body, which would be, as I said, maybe moving the point of focus around. Every three breaths you move it. Or think of, where are my hands, where are my feet, where are my hands and my feet.
So the goal, mm-hmm, is then having an experience of clarity and wakefulness in the body with stillness, or not having to then direct the breath, or?
Well, and there comes a point where you don't have to direct the breath anymore, and we'll be getting into stages of concentration as we go on. But first things first, you've got to establish that frame of reference, and just keep it there. Second point, you sounded a little embarrassed about the word goal.
Yes, I was thinking that, yes, I mean, I assumed that the more you strive, the more you're kind of trying to cling to something or to achieve something.
There are good things to achieve, cling to, and bad things to cling to. That's what it comes down to. Yes. Well, you're not the first one I've noticed that. This is a problem. No, the Buddha actually says, as I said earlier, that what he talked about, the what he called literally the sorrow not of the flesh, which is that, you know, I want to be awakened and I'm not there. And he doesn't say to drop that. He says actually to cultivate that in a skillful way. And a lot of the practice is learning how to have a mature attitude towards your goals, maintain the goal, and learn how to have a mature attitude towards it, so you don't just start beating yourself up because here it is the second day of the retreat and I haven't even gotten jhana yet. 20 years. Okay. I'd do a little beating at that point. But not too much, okay. Yes. Well, I'm not finished with the goals here. Because there is that attitude that, you know, I feel much more comfortable if I didn't have any goals. And see, I've let go of the goal and I'm happy. And there's an analogy the Buddha gives of, you know, someone who's trying to get milk out of a cow and they're squeezing the horn. And you can squeeze and squeeze and squeeze and you're not going to get any milk. And finally someone comes along and says, you know, you really ought to stop squeezing the horn. And so you stop squeezing the horn, and you feel much better, but you still don't have the milk. You know? You got to know where to squeeze. You know. So have a goal, and then, you know, take it seriously, and then ask yourself, you know, okay, am I getting toward the goal? Am I going away from the goal? And exactly what is pulling me away? And use that to sort yourself out. Question. Okay.
So the frame of reference is one of the four.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's not more particular than that.
Well, you can decide out of the four main frames of reference that you're going to stick with breath. Right. And then just stay with your breath. Mm-hmm. Or whatever. And within the So with the feelings, you might say just two different kinds of feelings. If there's a pleasure, you try to address whether your feelings fall as what they call feelings of the flesh or feelings not of the flesh. The feelings of the flesh are just general sensory pleasures and pains. Not of the flesh is things that have to do with the actual, like the grief of the practice, of not being at your goal in the practice, or the pleasure of feeling that you're on a path that feels really secure. And you want to notice distinctions like that. And usually it's best at the beginning to give yourself just one distinction to focus on. You would watch how they manifest in the body. I mean, it's impossible not to be able to see the two at the same time. But the question is, where is your main focus? Because then you'd be able to check, okay, if I'm working with the breath properly, this feeling of pleasure will become greater, or the feeling of pleasure becomes less. And we are trying to maximize the pleasure at that state. That the other part is this, when they talk about the man abhorring pain and desiring pleasure, that's not to be abandoned. And when you hear this thing over and over again, the great path is not the great way is not hard for those with no preferences. The only way I can make sense out of that is that you do whatever is required to put an end to suffering. But you do prefer the end of suffering to continued suffering. So there is a preference lying behind that. It's just learning how to approach it skillfully. Yes. Well, if you find it calms you down, it's perfectly okay.
It does calm, okay. Yes, but then...
I find, though, that if you're using a mantra, you want to couple it with your breath. And then once you're really with the breath, then you can drop the mantra. Because the breath will take you to deeper stages of concentration.
I think that's what I'm missing, is the deeper part after the
calming after
the mantra.
Yeah. Okay, then you just drop the mantra, stay with the breath. Okay. Question? Yeah.
So would you consider this a form of mind training, using the body as an anchor? And the four reference points are the breath, feelings, body, and...
Well, breath is part of the body, and then you have feelings of pleasure and pain, mind states, and then what they call mental qualities, which are these lists of different Dharma topics that you use as a frame of reference at different points in your practice to try to read if something's wrong with the mind, what do I do?
Okay, but the beginning is becoming aware of what's going on, what your mind is doing.
Right.
And then perhaps delving into, without being terribly over-analytical, what purpose is this serving?
Right.
It's just passing.
Just let it pass, yeah. But you start with the body as your anchor. And then as you said, if it's passing, you're fine. If something comes up and it's coming up again and again, you say, I've got to deal with this first because it's getting in the way. In which case, you drop the body as your frame of reference and you start looking at the issue in the mind. And that's when you use one of the other frames of reference as your guide to kind of analyzing, well, what's going on here. Yeah. You're resting and then you work, you know.
I'm wondering, do you do that work from what you learn while you're in the practice and then you take it out into the world and work it, or do you work constantly while you're in the practice?
You do it both, actually. I mean, while you're sitting and meditating, sometimes you go through a whole session and not much comes up. And you just say, okay, this is my chance to rest. And you allow the body to rest. And then there are other times when things will come up and you realize, okay, I've got to deal with this now. And you can't wait until you've perfected concentration before you start analyzing things. If you take whatever strength you've got, whatever knowledge you have, and see if you can apply that to that problem. Now, if you apply it to the problem and everything is getting very dull and you say, okay, I'm not ready for this one yet, I'll put it aside. I know it's there. I'm not denying that the problem is there, but I've got to go back and work on my concentration more until you feel ready to tackle it again. So a lot of the practice is just that, learning how to gauge the situation, what needs to be done now. What am I up for?